Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Joe Maggio, please welcome.
Thank you.
Okay. Great. Well, so just to get a little bit of background before we get into this film, because which is set in Chicago. I don't think it was originally written for Chicago. Tell us a bit about what you were doing before Michael Mann came along. I mean, you were in the police. You were cop and detective for a long time.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, but that was, I forget that I was, it was so long ago. I met Michael, they needed some technical help on a film they were doing in Chicago, Thief. And through a mutual friend, we met Michael and helped him on the set a little bit. And then one day he called and asked if I wanted to do a little part in a movie.
You make it sound easy. So I mean, what
it was
your...
kind of easy.
Yeah?
It was. It was fun. We went there and... I was just interested in the way things were on a movie set. I, of course, had never been on one, and I was interested in what was going on. There was, you know, a lot of action and a lot of equipment that I still don't know what it's for, but it was fun to be there, interesting to be there.
And what was, you know, you do really sort of have an effortless style. What was your approach to sort of learning the craft? I mean, I'm starting with a sort of big question, but your approach to learning the craft of acting, because you really just make it seem like an easy thing to do, but you're a really special actor.
Well, thank you. you know, with me, it's always been pretty simple. If someone sends me a script and I like it, and I, you know, I can do it and they want me to do it, I do it.
Okay.
And, you know, I really never, I'm not one of those people that go and hide and stuff like that.
Okay.
Uh-huh. I don't do that.
Or one of these people who spends months sort of doing method acting, preparing.
No, no. I wouldn't know how.
And you're great at cursing on screen. This is sort of one of the, you know, one of your natural talents is just your ability to curse, even in front of a girl, you know, in this film. But where did that come from?
That is natural.
Yeah, okay.
It's funny because we would, you know, my parents wouldn't tolerate swearing in the house or anything, but as soon as I hit that street, boy, you know, it all came out. And sometimes, you know, it's fun and sometimes it's appropriate. I think you can overdo it, you know, and I hope I never do that because then it loses its impact a little bit. Believe it or not, I've taken curse words out of a film, you know, because I just sort of thought it was too much.
Yeah.
I did.
It was one of the last things we, you know, we worked a lot on the script together. Dennis had ideas. And then one of the last things I remember you said, now, I think there may be too many fucks in there, basically. So we went through and page by page and we removed quite a few.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of them. And, it just didn't seem appropriate. But I remember Joe telling me, when you talked a little to Meredith, our little girl, Angela, just talk to her like she's another guy.
Yeah, that was great, those scenes.
Just talk to her like she's another guy, not a 7 or 8-year-old little girl.
So I'll ask one thing, then we'll get into the film. But working with Gene Hackman, first of all, Get Shorty just is just one of the great movies about movie making and such a wonderful comedy. What was, you know, Gene Hackman, what's it like working with him and then finding out that what you're going to do with him is beat, you know, beat the crap out of him?
Yeah, it was funny. It's a little funny because I read Elmore Leonard just, you know, as a matter of course. And I read Get Shorty and I said, boy, oh boy, this would be a good movie someday. And it seems to me that it was a month or so later I got a call from Danny DeVito, his office, and him and... asked me to come to a table reading of Get Shorty.
Yeah.
And then right after that, we were doing it, it seems like. But my memory, you know, is... and I'm a big fan of Gene Hackman's. I think he's, you know, probably the best around nowadays. But My big concern was I didn't want to hit him with that phone. You know, I was a little afraid, you know, and we rehearsed it, and I don't know if you've ever seen him, but he's a formidable guy. He's a big guy. And, you know, he's a Marine and, you know, all of that stuff. And I didn't want to, you know, get Gene Hackman mad at me. So he says, no, don't worry about it. Don't worry. He says, just come as close as you can. We'll be okay. I said, okay. You know, and I kept coming closer and everything, but he was right there. He was in it, and we were throwing each other around that office pretty good, you know.
Yeah.
He was great. He was great about it.
So let's talk about this film. It's I guess if I just want to start sort of asking you how it came about. It really has the feeling of something that's very personal. So first of all, how did you decide to write it? And then of course I do want to hear about how the casting went. But go ahead.
Well, it is large. Joe May is largely inspired by my maternal grandfather. Not exactly Joe May, but very Joe May like in many ways. He was. Had a number of different jobs. He was a prize fighter. He was a salesman. His trunk was always full of things like cookie jars or transistor radios, anything he could sell. And he sold wine for a period of time, I remember. But he was, you know, he was always upbeat. He was always up. He would be out all night, always, you know, his hair impeccably combed, always. He would never leave if he wasn't, you know, close shaven, and always looked great in his clothes. And he was not a rich guy, you know, but he kept his clothes, always looked amazing. And he'd be out all night smoking and drinking and, you know, shaking people's hands. And then he'd be the first guy up in the morning. You know, we spent a lot of time with him. He was always up first thing in the morning. He would, you know, give us a bowl of Cheerios. And he was just this, you know, cooking for everyone and stuff. So, you know, inspired by stories that, you know, over the years had been told about my grandfather. And he wound up actually dying not quite so gloriously. So I thought that would be great to redeem him somehow and let him go out with a bang in a movie. So, but then there were other films that had sort of inspired me at the time. Umberto D, if you've seen that.
Sure, Vittorio De Sica. Yeah,
Vittorio De Sica, Umberto D on Atlantic City, which is one of my all-time favorite films. I love Burt Lancaster in that film. In fact, I was afraid it might be too similar, the way he looks, the way he dresses, the whole thing, but whatever, you know. So those were sort of the inspirations going into it.
And so, you know, both those films that you mentioned require a great actor in the lead. They're really portrait films. I mean, you're in just about every scene. So how did you come to do this, you know, get involved?
Well, we originally were going to shoot it in Brooklyn. It was set in Brooklyn. We had financing and through Bill Strauss, who's here in the back row there, looks like Lex Luthor. Bill had put together financing with an ex, a former NBA guy who had a big entertainment company, and we were shooting in New York, and we were looking around for actors, you know, that we thought would work. We wanted it to have that authentic Brooklyn feel, so we were looking for like Brooklyn guys, and then shortly after we got started, the economy fell apart, and this the NBA guy got cold feet, and I think he disbanded his company or something. But we lost our financing, and Bill had worked with Stephanie Striegel, who's another producer on Joe May, at New Line, and she was now running Dennis as a company, a development company. And so he said, let's send it to Dennis Farina and, you know, see what they say. And Dennis, you guys read it right away, and you were interested, and we just knew that. I mean, I think of Dennis as Chicago. I mean, when I you know, when I hear Dennis or look at him, I think Chicago. There's just no other place that he can be from. And Bill is originally from Chicago. He felt very strongly that we would have to move things to Chicago, and so we met with Dennis, and he agreed that would be a good idea, and that he would help us to resituate it. You know, we had to change some some quite a bit of stuff, actually.
But, so. And this was filmed in near areas where you were very familiar with?
Yeah, I actually filmed in a neighborhood that would have been just a little south of where I was born and raised, in an area they call the Patch. Hmm. I was raised in an area years ago that they used to call Little Sicily. So, but I was familiar with the area. And we picked the area because Joe wanted a piece of pizza one day. And there's this wonderful bakery called D'Amato's. Hmm. And they have nice, thick pan pizza. Hmm. And it was on the corner of Grand and May. And Joe said, look, Grand Avenue and May, just like Joe May. And then we looked around, and everything we needed was really within a 4 or 5 block area. We shot most of it right there.
It was actually the last neighborhood that we'd seen. We'd spent days looking at all neighborhoods. We went to Gary, Indiana. I mean, we were driving everywhere. Wow. And finally, very early on when I had first gone to Chicago, Dennis had said, we were driving around, and Dennis just pointed down the street, said, by the way, if you like sheet pizza down there, D'Amato's Bakery, you got to get a pizza. And just, that was it. Like, didn't even finish the sentence. But I like food. I like pizza. And I kept it in my head. And so after all these days of location scouting, I said, you know, Dennis had mentioned once this place for sheet pizza. Let's call it a day and let's go get some sheet pizza. And that was D'Amato's, and we wound up. Yeah.
So tell us your sort of view of Joe May. He's such a great character. You know, somebody who the way you were describing your grandfather, he sort of keeps a kind of dignity, you know, no matter how kind of pathetic his situation might be, you know, that coat that he's so proud about, and just the way he has a sort of code. You know, you feel like he has a private code.
Yeah, he does. I think he wears that coat like a, you know, like a cape of, you know, of royalty, and I think he does have a code, you know, and it may not work for everyone else, but it's certainly something that has worked for him.
Yeah.
Through the years, and that's why I think he doesn't get involved romantically with Jenny.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. He has the opportunity. I mean, that's a sort of nice moment. Did you see that maybe going differently?
I wanted it to go differently, but Dennis... No, just kidding. No. Absolutely. I mean, that was something that Dennis and I agreed on very early on, was that, you know, Joe's had, you know, a series of losses. The guy, and no one takes him seriously, and... he's kind of a joke, and you know, in the neighborhood, but he does have a you know, his ideals and a code, and he lives up to it. And he, you know, he's a very principled guy in many ways, and at the same time, he's flawed. But it's not that he doesn't have ideals; it's that you know, time has moved on, and the things that he values, the things, you know. His code is it's like devalued currency. You know, he's holding Confederate dollars or something. So, but he definitely is very, I think, you know, he has his rules and he lives, you know, abides by them.
I said something in the beginning, you know, in the introduction, that I wonder what you both think about, that this film to me evoked an earlier type of earlier period in American film, which of the 70s, movies like Eddie Doyle with, you know, the Robert Mitchum film. I'm wondering if either of you sort of had that in mind. It really has that kind of atmosphere.
Well, Joe certainly did. It happens that we both like those kinds of films.
Yeah.
And he mentioned to me, he said, think of Eddie Coyle, the Friends of Eddie Coyle, Robert Mitchum movie. And I rented it again. I watched it, and I liked it. It was, you know, it was much better when I saw it later. And he was, Joe's influenced by Umberto D.
Yeah, and even the name, like those films, some of those films, they had the long, you know, The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, The Friends of Eddie Coyle. I wanted it to have a long name like that, you know, The Last Rites of Joe May. To me, it sounds like a movie from that period. But yeah. I just, you know, it felt to me like from that, the early 70s, Hollywood was making some really great, like what would now be, you know, independent films. I mean, really taking chances on characters and really, you know, great acting, great story. And it wasn't just all action, you know, there was a lot of character development, and I really wanted it to have that kind of feeling. And I think Joe looks, you know, if you took a snapshot of Joe May, he could be from that period. You know, everything he's wearing is circa 1973 or 74, you know. So definitely was very interested, not in making a pastiche, but, you know, having it be like an homage to those films, for sure. So, and I think Joe May is a great, you know, character, a great anti-hero, you know, yeah. Much like, you know, Eddie Coyle or in The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, Ben Gazzara's character is, what's his name? I forget his name now, but, you know, these guys that are just so imperfect but have a code, and yeah. But, you know, it's just the world has just sort of changed in such a way that there's no place for them anymore. So,
were you kind of drawing on people that you knew maybe from your days in Chicago, sort of characters? Or?
Not consciously, but yeah. I certainly, you know, have known guys like Joe May, and I still know a few of them. There's, and they've seen the movie. They go, yeah, good. Yeah, that's good. You know, you shouldn't have mentioned the Fugazi watches. You know, they're still, they see policemen in their, you know, in their suit. And, you know, don't mention, you know, but it was good. So I knew guys like that. But I think it's a mistake, anyway, for me, to bring some preconceived notion into a film. And I never do. I never bring any past experience or anything like that into it. Because then you have to talk yourself out of it if the director has another vision of the movie, you know. Yeah. And all the things that you thought you wanted to do, if Joe says, well, I don't want you to do that, then you got to start all over again. So I'd rather go in with a blank slate.
Yeah. And what was it like, and I'll open it up to the audience after this, but just having the opportunity to really have a whole film. I mean, to you know, we're so used to your great character work, and it was just sort of wonderful for people who appreciate your acting to be able to just see this character develop, you know, at the sort of nice pace of the film, and to really, this is such a great showcase. But yeah.
Yeah, I was a little surprised, you know, because when they sent me the movie, I saw Joe May, and then, you know, I kept seeing Joe May on the page, and, you know, and I was saying, do they really want me to play Joe May, or am I?
Are you going
to? Because usually I would be Lenny, or I would be, you know, Chelsea Ross's character, or, you know, some.
Right.
I don't know. You know,
which are good characters, but
yeah, which are wonderful characters, but, and that's where I really, you know, I thought that's what they wanted me for. I said, they want me to do Joe May. I said, well, okay, I'll do it. You know, I liked it right away. I mean, yeah. I was just, I read it, and I liked it. I related to it right away.
Okay, so actually, I will ask this, before, and then I promise I'll throw it open, but just what's the directing style? What's it like to direct Dennis Farina? Not to put you on the spot or anything.
Oh, no, not at all. You know, in the past, I'd worked very much in an ensemble style where I would work with the actors a lot for several months sometimes before we'd actually start shooting. We'd work on the script together, sit around, have long conversations about the character. And I didn't really get to do that so much. As we did talk about it. We talked about it a lot. We went through the script quite a bit. But you know, it wasn't that up on the feet, like actually going through the scenes kind of thing. And some of the actors, you know, I met 5 minutes before we started shooting. But with Dennis, I have to say it was a little bit, I was a little intimidated. It took me maybe a day and a half, I feel like, before I felt comfortable telling you that I wanted something else, or if you were doing something, just making adjustments.
Because he would beat you up every time.
No, yeah. Well, you know, he's a big guy, but not for that. It was just, I don't know, I was just intimidated, I have to be honest. And, I mean, when we first, you know, when I arrived on the first day, I just saw the size of the, you know, all the trucks and the Teamsters parking and the trailers and things like that, and I got very frightened. I felt like I was sort of overwhelmed by the weight of the production. I'd always done, you know, on most of my films, I'm cooking lunch for people, I'm driving everyone around in a van, you know, so this, it was very, and then to have Dennis walk on and for me to be trying to tell him what to do was, it was a little intimidating. So, but you know, I'll say that you knew all of your lines, always. You were absolutely had made your decisions beforehand, so we had something to work with. So it was very easy. What's difficult is when someone shows up and they don't know their lines and they're not really, they haven't really made any choices yet, and then you're just sort of having to create everything from the beginning. So, but we were pretty close in our
we pretty much agreed on, you know, on the overall theme of the movie, what his character was, yeah. How he treated his relationship between Jenny and Angela, and his big note to me always, and it was hard for me to do when I did the scenes with the little girl. You always want to hug her, you know, and you want to protect her and do, like, you know, and do the, you know, the manly thing, you know, I guess. And he used to tell me, don't be nice to that little girl. Don't fall in love with that little girl. Just, you'd be your Joe May. You haven't got time to fool around with her. And you're this. And I used to call him the Prince of Darkness, because this little girl came on the set, and she was so cute. But he was absolutely right.
It's great, you know? Chemistry, because you feel like she's kind of tough, too.
So yeah, and she's...
It's like a respect.
And if that happens, you know, if you it becomes a different movie,
yeah.
And if you have some kind of a relationship with Jenny, it's a different movie, you know. And Joe didn't want to make that movie, and largely I didn't either.
Yeah.
And,
you know.
Okay, so raise your hands if you have a question, and I'll repeat so everybody can hear. Go ahead. How long did it take to get, and you know, to sort of find that chemistry that you had with that young actress, or was that just sort of happened naturally?
Well, I met her. They called me. They said, "We think we have the little girl. You come on into the casting office." And I went in there, and I saw her face, and I thought she was just—it was just right. You know, it wasn't that she was so gorgeous or anything. It's just that it was just right. Yeah, and she wanted to. We did one scene with her, and she. Somebody told me this story. I forgot it. Someone reminded me of it, that she wanted to do another scene, and I said, "Well, you really don't have to, but if you want to, we will." And I said, "Well, what scene do you want to do?" She says, "I want to do the scene where I say shit." So we said, "Okay." So we did that scene. I think Bill reminded me of that. Yeah. So then I knew, you know, I mean, she. She had a sense of humor about herself, too. She was wonderful, wonderful to work with.
Following in your footsteps there. Yeah,
yeah, right. teach him young. Teach him young.
Good mentor. Okay. Dan, right in front here.
Now, it seemed to me there were a lot of people involved, from Steppenwolf, the theater company.
Oh, okay, yeah.
There were a lot of people that I had always enjoyed their work, mm-hmm. in the movies and in the theater. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, could you talk about the Steppenwolf Theater Company, a great theater company in Chicago, and how they were involved?
Sure. Years ago, my first film and my first few films actually came out of an ensemble that had been, you know, working with people from the Actors Studio. And Steppenwolf for us was like, the grail. I mean, it was just absolutely the ideal of you know, at what they were doing in Chicago and what they had achieved. Just seemed like something we really always aspired to. And I always kept it in the back of my mind that, you know, I'd love to somehow get involved with them, you know, in some way. So when we decided that we were going to shoot in Chicago, I told Bill, you know, why don't we try and get Steppenwolf involved somehow? Either they could offer us production support, you know, anything. I don't know what, some actors we could cast in their facilities, whatever. And it turns out they have Steppenwolf Films, which is a film arm of Steppenwolf, and they read Tim Evans, who's running that, read it and really loved the script, and they came on as producers. So we wound up casting a lot of the actors there, and they provided us with a lot of production support as well.
Really helped us get over the hump to have them there, and they've always been very, very nice. They're all, especially Tim Evans, just really nice, good people.
Hmm. Okay, over here. Yeah. Okay, so what advice would you give to 21-year-old actor?
Yeah. Well, it depends if he has a
if he has a
role in the picture for me or not. Depends. Will all depend on my answer. No, I would say don't get discouraged. You have to have a lot of patience, and don't let anyone sway him. Just keep doing it. You know, and if he can make a film with one person, or just get a camera in his hand, or be around an audio something or another, just let him do it, and don't get discouraged. I would say, and patience. You have to have a lot of patience. I mean, even when you're, it's funny. I won't mention his name, but I was in California some months ago, and I was sitting down with a pretty big shot director. And he was saying, God, where's, you know, my next job? I can't. And I was saying, this guy just came off of a huge. He's going, I don't know, man, if I'm ever going to work again and stuff like that. So you know, this business is full of stuff like that. But don't let him discourage it. If he loves it, let him go ahead and do it.
What was it like for you when you decided to move out to L.A.? You sort of took that was taking a plunge for you, wasn't it?
Well, I didn't move to L.A.
You didn't?
Thanks for following my career, but I never.
but you went out, but no, you decided to leave your job as a detective. And
I worked a lot in L.A.
I always lived in Chicago.
I tell you what happened for me is someone told me one day that, you know, you will not have to make that decision. It will be made for you. And sure enough, you know, they were right. And, you know, there comes that time when that does happen. But I would tell him not to get discouraged. Let him work and do whatever he wants to do.
Okay. Anybody else over here?
Which is an absolutely delightful film. You got very much enjoyable part of it. You can share some memories.
So, could you talk about Making Big Trouble, which is one of his favorite films, but not a huge box office hit?
I'll tell you what happened with Big Trouble, and there was another movie I did at the same time called The Sidewalks of New York.
The Ed Burns film,
The Ed Burns film, who I worked with a couple times. He's just a wonderful guy, and he's, I think, a really good filmmaker and a lot of fun to be around. I came to New York to do publicity for both of them. Big Trouble, as you know, is about sneaking a bomb on an airplane. And we were here on September 11th. So that movie, you know, went by the wayside for a long time because that's what the subject matter is. And in Sidewalks of New York, at the time, they were very skittish about showing the Twin Towers. And we were always either in front of the Twin Towers or the Twin Towers were in the background somewhere. So they were a little sensitive about showing that.
Yeah, the poster, I think, had the Twin Towers. The film was made before 9/11.
Right, before. And we were, I was at the Peninsula Hotel when all of that happened that day. So, consequently, the film never got out. So
wow.
That's what happened.
Okay, right down front here.
Thank you.
Can you talk about Code of Silence with Chuck Norris and Midnight Run?
Okay, two great performances. Code of Silence and Midnight Run, which is one of your most beloved roles.
Yeah, Code of Silence with Chuck Norris. Again, a lot of fun to do. It was directed by Andy Davis, and we did it in Chicago. It was one of the, I think maybe the second or third film that I did, and I like Chuck Norris. He was just a good guy. And at Midnight Run, I did in Las Vegas. I was doing Crime Story at the time. Right. Yeah. Oh, thank you. And I happened to be off for a couple weeks, and I got offered Midnight Run, and I talked to Michael Mann. I said, I have an offer to do a movie. What's the movie? Midnight Run. Who's in it? Robert De Niro. Who's directing it? Martin Brest. Yeah, you got to do the movie. So he says, go ahead and do the movie. If you need a few extra days or whatever, just go ahead and do it. But I had a wonderful time doing it. Robert De Niro has always been very nice to me. And Martin Brest was our director. We had a lot of fun. Charles Grodin was in the movie. And Martin Brest gave us, all of us, you know, a lot of leeway with language again and, you know, ad-libs and improv and stuff like that. Oh, thanks a lot. Yeah, yeah, thank you. It was fun. It was a lot of fun.
Who found the jacket in this film, your coat, your leather coat?
I did. The wardrobe girls came through with all of the wardrobe, and I saw this jacket, and I said, boy, this is really Joe May, and I hope Joe Maggio approves it. So I ran it by Joe, and we did the same thing. When I did Get Shorty, I was they sent some wardrobe through, and I saw a pink sport coat, and I said, that's it. That's Ray Barbone. That's it. Give me that pink sport coat. And that's how I find my character from my clothes.
Yeah, yeah.
It's true.
And Talented, you're working with Michael Mann again. I just do want to ask about the project you're working on now. Sounds great. The series that you're doing for HBO called Luck.
Yeah, we're doing a show called Luck over at HBO with myself and Dustin Hoffman and Nick Nolte. Joan Allen is in it. And Kevin Dunn and Michael Gambone. It's about racetracks, about what's happening to racetracks nowadays. And they're all kind of having a bad time. And it's about the big story is casinos taking over racetracks. And who's going to run those casinos? Who's going to operate them? Where's the money coming from? You know, there's a lot involved. How do you deal with the Indian casinos? All of that stuff gets explored in the series.
This may be a question either of you can answer, but how do you feel about TV versus film these days? Like, we're seeing all these great actors working on HBO. It's such a pleasure with this movie to just see it on the big screen. It has so much atmosphere in it. You know, really captures Chicago, and it's just a great, it really is a big screen movie. And was it a hard film to get made? And do you feel like, you know, what is this atmosphere out there now for making films like this?
It was hard to get. I mean, I think all films, I mean, every film is, I think everyone is having a hard time getting their films made now. Like you said, I mean, even the big directors that you can't imagine would have, you know, any trouble at all. It's always, you know, it's takes a lot of money, and people are very risk averse with their money these days. So, but it was actually originally the script. I intended it to be part of a 10-part series that I wanted to do for something like HBO or something. Mm. I could never get any traction anywhere. I got a little, got far with Showtime, and then eventually they dropped it. But I wanted to redo Kieslowski's Decalogue, actually, and set it in Brooklyn and have the stories intertwining. And I was going to say, that's one of the things about television that was for me, would be very exciting, is to be able to develop something slowly over time and not have it be limited to, you know, an hour and a half or an hour and 40 minutes. This was originally supposed to be a chapter in that Decalogue. TV, I think, is very exciting. I think some of the best stuff I'm seeing is on TV, on HBO, or, you know.
Yeah, I agree. I some of the stuff on HBO is a lot better than a lot of the stuff that's at the movies nowadays.
Oh yeah,
and they're very very nice. They treat you nicely. They give you a chance to develop stuff. They're not going to take you off the air in the first 10 minutes, you know, like they do at the network, and especially now at networks. Boy, if you don't make it in the first 3 weeks or so, you're gone. There's no looking back.
Yeah. Okay, right here. Then we, just do one more. Go ahead.
I always consider filming in Italy. My parents were from Italy, and I would love to go there. And I go almost every year to visit. I would love to work there. Okay.
Yeah, good tip. Right.
If he finds a nice spot in Florence or someplace like that, give us a call.
You're in, right? The one detail I wanted to ask about was, which I was interested to read about, was the pigeons. Because I read that you convince yourself that there could be pigeons in Chicago.
Not pigeons so much, but pigeon coops. I really wasn't sure if there were pigeon coops in Chicago. I mean, we all know that in New Jersey and New York, that they're all over, but I wasn't sure about Chicago. So we did the research, and there are pigeon coops in Chicago. They're not legal, but they're there, and we're not telling anybody where we found ours. So. That's right. I'm no stool pigeon.
I'm sure somewhere. I mean, but no, not that I'm aware of, but probably from the same part of Sicily, I'm sure. So, actually, May is Maggio is May, means May in Italian. So it's the last rites of Joe Maggio. Could be the last movie of Joe Maggio. I don't know.
Yes.
Thank you. You know what? I mean, I'm a big Hemingway fan. So, he, you know, although Hemingway was not a filmmaker, I do subscribe to a lot of his ideas about writing. And, you know, he's wrote once that, writing fiction is not knowing what to put in. It's knowing what to take out. And, you know, the script was very short. I mean, I felt trimmed it down to is absolutely, you know, is minimal as it could get. And so it does, I think, maybe have a bit of the Hemingway influence, I hope, you know, in that it is very, you know, people don't talk more than they need to talk. You know, things are very terse. And I think that's a very appropriate analogy. Thank you very much.
Tell her about the meat scene. What happened? How you came about
the meat scene? What do you mean?
The meat scene.
What about it?
How you came about to write it?
I don't remember. How did I come about to write it?
We went down to the meat market.
Yeah.
And you said you had to get the meat market in the movie.
Oh yeah.
Tell them the story. That's it.
That's it. We went down to the meat market, and we went to. Did you know him, Dennis Cipetti? How did we end up there?
The location manager knew the Cipettis from the meat market.
So we went, and, you know, it's Chicago, and it's the famous, you know, the stockyards. And when we walked in there, it's just overwhelming. I mean, the sea of animal carcasses and... And it was, I thought it was beef, but it was actually lamb. And it just seemed so appropriate to me that it be that there were all these slaughtered lamb everywhere, and you could actually, there was another room where you could hear them. There's a pen of live lamb, and they're was it baying? What did lamb do? And I felt that it was an appropriate thing for Joe because he really is like the slaughtered lamb. I mean, he's this guy that that is being led to his demise. So I thought seeing him carrying that meat around would be really a powerful image.
Great ending though with the dog too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It's just and a punishment for me, right? To carry that meat
I
all
think,
around.
You know what? I think, yeah.
Yeah, it was a punishment.
Is that what you felt? It was, yeah.
Well, what happened was...
How long did you... Originally,
the production designer had said that we legally could not carry real meat around. It was a health violation and a health...
Yeah.
And this was a union shoot. I mean, everything was like... union rule. I mean, Meredith would be pulled out from under my nose, like, and, you know, with 5 minutes notice because she had to have her tutor at a certain time. I mean, it was really, everything was really on the up and up. So they told me I cannot use real meat. I thought, all right, well, what are we going to do? And she said, we'll make a resin meat. It will look, we'll wrap it up. It'll look just like real meat. So the day... that we were shooting in the day, we were going to shoot that scene the next day, and they brought me the meat, and it was like that scene in Spinal Tap, where the Stonehenge is only 2 inches big, and it was supposed to be, so yeah. The meat was...
It was 18 inches instead of 18 feet.
Yeah. It looked like something you could tuck under your arm and walk, and so I was like, this just isn't going to do it. So we did actually then go Dennis Cipetti, cut us a big slab, and it was so I could barely pick it up. I don't know how you were carrying this thing around, and it was very sloppy and wet, and you hauled that thing around for a few days because we didn't get all the scenes of him trying to sell it at once. We'd be shooting somewhere, and I'd say, oh, that looks like a good back alley. Let's get these guys. Get the waiter clothes. Throw some of the extras in. And Dennis would get the meat and then go and pretend to try and sell it. And the final, the dog. I have to tell one story about the dog, though. The guy that did the birds, the pigeons, also did the dogs. And when I met him, he said, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I'm a dog specialist. I don't know anything about birds or pigeons, but I'm going to help you guys. I hope I can find some pigeons that we could get them to do what you need them to do. So we shot the pigeons first, and it was amazing. The guy showed up. He had hundreds of pigeons, and he'd let them go, and they'd circle, and they'd come back and do, you know, it was like they were just doing everything we wanted them to do. So I remember saying to Jay Silver, the director of photography, wow, this guy doesn't know anything about pigeons, and this is what we got. This dog is going to be fantastic.
Uh-oh. Oh, no.
And I had told him, he said, what kind of dog do you want? I said, I want a mean, nasty, missing hair, patch, mangy, junkyard dog, like the kind of dog that you see and you immediately run and jump on the nearest car because, you know, this thing is coming for you. He's like, I have just the dog, Joe. I've got the dog, really. And the night, again, it's always at the last minute. We showed up, light was just right, and I go over to his truck, and he opens it, and he's got in the back a border collie that looked like Lassie. It's clean, beautiful, and prancing around. And I was like, are you kidding? He said, this is a very mean dog. And I was like, but it looks like Lassie. I mean, this just isn't going to work. When we tried, and the way he'd done it was Dennis was going to hold the meat, but he also had a tennis ball that the dog was going to go for it. And we tried, and the dog was just jumping around and licking Dennis, and it was just a disaster. So then we wound up, someone found online these guys. They looked like characters out of Deliverance. They came, the ones I, you know, it was bizarre. They were, you know, could hear the banjo music. And they had that dog, and that dog was a mean dog. I was worried about Dennis. I really was. When that thing went at, the first time it went at you, I thought it was going to bite your hand off. I mean, so.
So you took a little abuse for this film with the meat and
I took a lot of abuse actually, and then meat was always bleeding through.
Yeah.
You know, and the blood would come out, and, you know, it was sticky, and it was cold, and then this dog came along, the second dog, and we couldn't stop him. You know, he was just coming at that meat all the time. You know, I told Joe, keep shooting, man, because and then he was, you know, he hung on, and I was lifting him up. He's dangling and everything. We couldn't get rid of him.
It was one take.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you'd work with Joe again still?
I don't know about that.
Okay, last question, then we're going to wrap it up. Yeah. Okay. Photography.
Thank
beautiful
you.
Photography.
Yeah, Jay Silver. Yeah, director of photography. He's a good friend of mine. We needed, the way we got him, we needed, for tax purposes, we needed an Illinois-based director of photography. And we were looking at all these guys that I had never met in Chicago, and they were all wonderful people. But I just wanted, you know, it's important to have a personal relationship with your director of photography. And I was complaining about this, that I was going to have to work with a complete stranger, to a friend of mine, who Larry Fessenden, who's a filmmaker in New York. And he said, I think Jay Silver's got an Illinois driver's license. You should give him a call. And so I called Jay, and he still had his Illinois driver's license. He was from Chicago originally, but yeah, I mean, he's been in New York forever. And and I'd known Jay for a long time. And so that's how he was, by accident. And he turned out to be such a great co-creator. I mean, he really, and it was hard and cold. And he had we shot on the Red, which is a gigantic camera. A lot of it was handheld. And, you know, to be standing out in Chicago in December, the lenses freezing up. But the whole look, he came to me and he said, you know, I want you to watch these movies. But the one movie that we really felt we wanted to somewhat emulate, because it was using, we thought, really effectively the wide screen, was Michael Clayton. And I liked the colors. I liked the way, you know, it was very dark, and a lot of the time they weren't afraid to let characters just completely go black, and which is something that we did.
Yeah.
And we had this special chip that had just come out for the Red camera, which allowed you to shoot full 2.35, which is that very wide screen, and we wanted to utilize, not just have it be a wide screen with a big head or something, you know, like really use to capture the city, that the wide aspect ratio. So and he just, it was great. I mean, I didn't have to worry about the camera at all. I just focused on keeping Dennis in line. And
okay, well, you guys both did amazing work on this film, so thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.